It actually looks like a car. It drives like a car. It is 100% car. If you look closer, it is actually an aircraft, but it looks like a car, drives like a car, and it's just regular EV car.
Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. It's Friday, July 12th. I'm Stephen Overly. One perk of reporting on flying cars is that you get to see a whole lot of wild ideas. And it just doesn't get more wild than Aleph Aeronautics. You just heard their CEO, Jim Duchovny, describing the Model A, which looks like a sports car until it lifts up off the ground and flies. Now, I was a bit skeptical, and still am, because like a lot of flying cars, most images of the Model A are renderings or prototypes. But Jim tells me the real thing is being tested and could be out next year. On yesterday's show, we talked about our long-standing fascination with the flying car. If you missed that, go check it out now. Today, I'm diving into the nitty-gritty and talking with Jim from Aleph Aeronautics and Mike Whitaker, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, essentially people who are making these cars and who are regulating them. See, flying cars may seem all fun and futuristic, but the government is taking them seriously, and Whitaker's agency is writing rules now that will shape how the industry grows.
You're going to start seeing aircraft certified, I think, next year that would be referred to by some as flying cars. We're really at the beginning of that era. We're going to start seeing them in the marketplace.
Before leading the FAA, Whitaker actually worked at a flying car company called Supernal. First up, here's my conversation with him, where he explains the government's plan to make these things safe.
Glad to be here.
Where is the FAA on the flying car? When am I going to be flying around in one of these?
I guess it depends on what you mean by a flying car. Some of these flying cars look a lot like helicopters. I mean, there have been so many iterations. I think if you look at what the actual modern car looks like, you could sort of say they all sort of look the same because there's been alignment around what's the optimal design, whether it's a sedan or an SUV. And, you know, the designs don't really change that much. But if you look at the variety of AAM and other sort of new aircraft, they're all over the place. There has not been a consensus. This is the one that's going to, you know, carry us through the decades. So I think we're in a place where we're watching that change pretty rapidly.
Right.
And I suspect in 20 years, it's going to look a lot different than it does now. You're going to start seeing aircraft certified, I think, next year that would be referred to by some as flying cars. We're putting rules together for the operation of those aircraft because you won't be able to operate them without rules that are bespoke to those aircraft. So I think we're really at the beginning of that era. We're going to start seeing them in the marketplace.
Being in your position right now in this moment, how do you navigate that when you have all of these different designs and all of these sort of unanswered questions about how this technology will change things up?
So we've had to take a different approach than the normal approach to certifying new vehicles. The technology is changing so quickly that you need a more flexible approach, but you also need to keep the system safe. And so we try to balance those two dynamics. We've migrated over the years to a more of a performance-based approach, certifying vehicles as long as they can prove that they can perform certain functions. So rather than getting into the details of the design, just show us that you can make it do what it's supposed to do and do it safely. So it allows us to be a little more nimble in how we certify products. But, you know, a lot of what folks are talking about in the future hasn't been invented yet. So it's hard to really create rules about something that doesn't exist yet. So we're trying to really keep up with that dynamic.
Well, let me ask about timeline, because I know that the FAA introduced a plan last year that seems to sort of get these vehicles in the sky perhaps as soon as 2028. But does that mean, you know, regular people like me will be flying in them at that time?
I think it goes back to some of the early versions of cars, airplanes, and cell phones. You know, they weren't widely available when they first came out, and they were often very expensive. But over time, as they get refined and as production increases, you bring the cost down and they become more widely available. So I think we'll see that same dynamic, but it'll take a while. And if you look at a company, if they're making 50 or 80 aircraft a year, those are going to be pretty expensive items. But if they're making 300,000 of those a year, they're more akin to cars and they start to be priced more like cars. And I think some of the use cases are particularly interesting to connect, for example, faraway suburbs to urban areas where the jobs are. So you, instead of having a two-hour commute in a car, if you could have a 30-minute ride in an advanced air mobility vehicle, that's a pretty compelling use case.
You mentioned safety being kind of a guiding principle for the FAA. When I think about scenarios to worry about, perhaps in this, you know, flying taxi, flying car future, what exactly is the plan to keep these things from crashing into each other or into other aircraft that share the sky?
So our primary focus, of course, is safety of the current system, the airline industry that moves so many tens of thousands of passengers every day, to make sure that's not interfered with. So we do focus particularly on trying to ensure that in these early phases, those aircraft are separate from that network, but over time, figuring out how to integrate them safely. I think some of the new technologies will make that more feasible, the detect and avoid technologies that allow the vehicles themselves to stay safe and separated. But that is something that we'll really have to look at closely as the industry ramps up.
And, you know, there's obviously debate around to what degree we need humans powering motor vehicles on the ground. Do you envision humans piloting these aircraft?
Well, I think most of the startups are envisioning a human in the cockpit. Interesting thing about automation is a lot of automation has been in aircraft for a really long time. And the difference between aircraft and cars is that in aircraft, you have a lot more time for the vehicle to take action to avoid a situation. In cars, you often have just a split second. But a lot of the flying that gets done today involves a lot of automation, the autopilot that we're all familiar with. But there are even technologies now that have auto land features where in an emergency, someone can push a button and the vehicle just find an airport and land. So that technology, and then, of course, the drone technology that's been around for decades, particularly in the military, that technology is pretty advanced. So there's no reason to not have piloted vehicles. I think the question is, are people ready to get in those yet? And I think maybe not.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, I think people are still comforted by the idea of a human pilot on a commercial aircraft. I can't imagine a smaller, more personal device necessarily feeling a whole lot safer without one on board.
Yeah, I think, you know, we do get used to things over time. I remember the first time I rode on a airport train that didn't have a conductor. It's hard to even imagine a train like that having a conductor now. They're all automated, but it was kind of a strange experience with no one driving the train. So, you know, we get used to things, but I think it'll take a lot to get folks used to not having a human there to intervene or take control of the vehicle.
We've seen recently a surge in concern about the safety and construction of commercial aircraft, particularly planes built by Boeing, given, you know, the recent reports surrounding the company. Against that backdrop, how do you convince people that these new forms of flight are adequately regulated?
Well, I think the requirements to get certified for a vehicle are pretty stringent. And I think you hear a lot about what companies go through to get that. It's a multi-year process. There's a huge amount of flight testing. What we look for is adequate redundancy in the systems so that there's no single point of failure that can result in a safety of flight issue. And I think I would say that from the entrants in this market, they know that they have to maintain that level of safety or the market's never going to accept vehicles that aren't really keeping it to the level that you expect with a commercial airliner, which is really an extraordinarily high level of safety. So that's our target. And I think most of the industry is pretty aligned around that. They know that this won't work if you can't achieve that level of safety.
I know you were saying before that you have performance-based metrics to prove that models work. What are those key metrics that demonstrate, okay, this one is safe and it functions as expected?
Well, there are all kinds of different ones. It's durability of the parts of the aircraft. It's the ability to perform certain maneuvers. It's really a variety of tests that are designed specifically for the vehicle to show that it's airworthy and is going to be safe. It's a very high bar, but it requires often hundreds of hours of testing to prove that it can meet those standards.
Have you been in one of these flying car models, either, you know, as an administrator or when you were working at Supernal?
I have not flown in one. I've operated a couple simulators, but I have not flown in one.
How was the simulator?
They're impressive. I think the impression I took away was the simplicity of operation versus a traditional fixed wing or helicopter operation. They're designed to be much, much easier to operate. And the transition from vertical flight to horizontal flight is not a noticeable thing from the pilot's perspective. It doesn't go up and make a big rumbly noise and then shoot off in a horizontal direction. It's a very seamless transition. So those were sort of my initial impressions.
I wonder if you think out beyond the next few years, what does the future of personal flight look like to you? I mean, do you envision, you know, some new network of flying cars and launch sites and roadways in the sky, or is this something that will feel integrated into the system we have now?
Well, it has to be integrated. And I think leveraging those 5,000 public airports in the country, it does open up different business models. That's where you really need to just see where the market's going to take you and what kind of services get offered. But I do think, you know, we were talking about electric propulsion earlier. The other advantage of it is it's dramatically less expensive to operate. The maintenance is much lower and the cost per mile is much lower. So it allows you to disrupt sort of the cost curve, if you will, in aviation, which has always been that a seat on a big airplane is cheaper than a seat on a small airplane. So there could be some really interesting use cases and ways to connect communities with 9-seat aircraft, for example, under the current rules. If you had electric aircraft, you could really provide a lot of low-cost service with that type of an aircraft to smaller communities.
You know, often with new technologies and innovations, there's sort of three timelines, if you will, like the development of the technology, the progress of the regulation, and then public attitudes and adoption. I wonder, of those three, what's kind of farthest along and what's farthest behind when it comes to this new aviation technology?
I think that the adoption is the furthest behind. I think that's yet to come. You know, a lot of people who fly on commercial airlines have never flown in a small aircraft, and it is a profoundly different experience. And it can be a little bit of turbulence. What you might not even feel in a large commercial aircraft can really jostle you around in a small one. So I think that's going to take some getting used to. I know there's some research around technology to try to smooth those flights out. But at the end of the day, being in a small light aircraft is a somewhat unique experience that's not going to be for everybody.
Is there still a future in which you think people will own personal flying cars?
I think that there certainly will be a future where people own personal flying vehicles, call them cars if you'd like. But I think it is probably more likely that you'll have a wide availability of on-demand services for that type of transportation. So you don't necessarily have to own the vehicle, but you can hail it for a ride and it'll come get you and take you where you want to go. So I think that's the interesting future that awaits.
I guess one last question for you. Is a flying car something you'd like to own yourself someday?
You know, ownership is maybe not my goal, but I would certainly like to have that as a transportation option that would be available to me. I mean, I live in Washington and base out of Washington, but also have a home in Vermont. So getting back and forth is a challenge. There are a number of ways to do it, but having other transportation options there that either connected me from here to Boston or took me the whole way could be pretty amazing.
Well, Administrator Whitaker, appreciate you joining us on Politico Tech.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
All right. So Mike Whitaker and the FAA are hustling to regulate this emerging space without grounding this new form of transportation. But the flying car market is now full of all of these startups offering their view of what this future looks like. As I said earlier in the show, that led me to Jim Duchovny at Aleph Aeronautics, a company based in San Mateo, California. They were actually the first company to get a special certification from the FAA to do test flights. Their CEO tells me what it will take to get from test flights to real flights. Here's that conversation. Jim, welcome to Politico Tech.
Thanks, Dan.
So we're talking about flying cars. I was looking at the flying car your company makes. It's a lot cooler, honestly, than some of the others I've seen, which just look like helicopters. But our listeners won't be able to see it. So how would you describe what it looks like?
So it kind of looks like a regular sports car. But if you look closer, you're going to see some differences. So first of all, there is something called mesh. So imagine on top of the car is not solid, but it's actually in kind of like a checkered pattern in which there are holes for allowing airflow to come through. That's the first difference you would see. The second difference you would see is inside, there's actually no engine. There's no engine and there's no trunk. So where are they? There are four smaller engines in four wheels. There is a propeller, speed controller, motor, battery systems. There is eight of them, four in the front and four in the back. They're completely independent. This is very important. They're controlled by several computers. But when it's on the ground, it looks like a regular car. And when it flies, it actually has the same shape, but the sides of the car are actually shaped in a wing shape, in a very particular airfoil. So if you look closer, it is actually an aircraft, but it looks like a car, drives like a car, and it's just a regular EV car.
The flying car has kind of long been this idea of the future, right? This like technology that's unrealized. How do you convince people that it's not just a sci-fi fantasy anymore?
It's very simple to convince people, and you're absolutely correct. Unfortunately, flying car got a bad term, especially here in Silicon Valley. And people started calling every electric helicopter, which is eVTOL, flying car, right? Just because flying car was seemed to be impossible. And I had a hard time convincing people, including NASA directors when we talked to them and many other people who like with a really good knowledge. I found actually to show the video, or even better, to actually show them in person the car driving, taking off, and flying in front of them. I did not find any other good way of convincing people, but they believe their own eyes. That's the only way I found how to convince people.
And so you've actually flown in the car that you're developing?
So like I mentioned, we've been flying for actually more than 3 years now, the full size, everything here. But there are there used to be no public videos on the internet. Actually, some of them leaked. I'm not sure how some media got from my private YouTube account. So now some of this leaked. But there is a reason we actually don't want to show them. Thanks to Steve Jobs, now it not only matters that things have to function as you expect, they also have to look as you expect. So what we're doing right now is we're working on exterior. We're actually making on the look and interior, right? Doing the cabin, doing the outside. First impression matters. So when we were actually doing the demo, we want to show that nice sports looking car and not the prototype, which actually is exactly the same from mechanical shape, airflow. Everything is the same except how it looks like.
You mentioned getting the FAA approval to do this testing, which I believe you got last year. What are the other kind of regulatory hurdles that this technology, that your car kind of has to overcome still on the road to actually being a real marketable product?
Right. So it is already a real marketable product, but here's the interesting thing, and that's what I thought actually you're going to ask first. So different countries have different regulations. And more favorable regulations specifically to our vehicle are actually in Canada, UK, Italy, and other countries, not in the United States. So our target market is the United States. That being said, other countries do have at this point laws which are more favorable to us. So we plan to start actually outside the United States, even though all of our R&D, all the testing, everything happens in the United States. So we have to certify the same way Tesla did the certification. In the air, we're regular aircraft. So we have to certify similar to other aircrafts, right? Our advantage, and this is the reason I said we can start with Canada, UK, Italy, and several other countries, and several Asian countries, for example, is because we are ultralight in most of the countries, which means the weight of the aircraft is less than the threshold when it's classified as an ultralight. And ultralight in at least countries I mentioned does not need to have certification. It needs to have a registration. Just to give you an example, in the United States, the limit of the weight is 254 pounds. In Canada, it's 1,200 pounds.
I see. So it's in a sense, then there's maybe fewer regulatory barriers in some other countries outside of the U.S. So starting there and then eventually coming to the U.S. market.
So it just happened that we fall into that particular category. So ultralight, on one hand, you can actually literally fly that today in Canada, UK, Italy, and several, actually many countries you can fly today. But there is a limitation. You cannot fly over densely populated areas. You cannot fly over Toronto. You cannot fly over London. You cannot fly over Rome. So in order for us to have a full certification, actually, United States doing a good job. They just passed several laws right now to make it simpler. There's a nice, I hope it will be healthy. It is healthy right now. Competition between United States and China on the AAM, Advanced Air Mobility, which is happening because there's a lot of innovation happening here and there. So I think actually United States doing a good job on the full certification, especially the new head of FAA, who actually came, as you know, from an AAM background.
You mentioned pre-orders, and you know, we should note the company has said 3,200 people have already pre-ordered the Model A, it's called. When will they actually start to get the vehicle, and how soon can they get in the air?
The phrase which I usually say, and usually media just prints the last word of that sentence. So gladly, your guys are podcasts, so the whole sentence will be there. If everything goes right, if regulations do not change, we plan to start production of the first one by the end of 2025. Every word in that sentence matters, and usually media prints 2025. So the whole sentence matters.
Well, I know it does. I mean, you're trying to develop the technology. You're trying to clear whatever regulatory hurdles need to be cleared. You know, we've talked to other folks about public opinion, right? You getting people to actually trust in this kind of technology. I mean, what's it like to navigate all of that?
You're absolutely correct. Each of these topics is incredibly, incredibly complex. And it's incredibly hard to navigate. But again, think about when cars versus horses, when cars only came in. We're going through kind of the same route. A lot of technology went through the same route. AI is trying to go through the kind of similar route now. So it is incredibly complex. Everything is complex. The reason it's complex because we're trying to do something which has never been done in history. But we know that there's a lot of technology before us went through the same thing. And we just go flow with it. Like, I mean, we did not expect the thing to be easy.
Interesting. I mean, when you think about like the future with flying cars, what does that look like to you? Like, do I take your flying car, the Model A, to commute to work or, you know, run errands? Is this just like a fun toy that like I, you know, race my other rich friends with? Like, what does the future look like to you?
Right. So I'm glad you're talking the word future because we have a long-term plans and a short-term plans. Short-term plans is you drive through Toronto, you get outside Toronto, you take off and you fly to your suburban house. That's a short-term plans. It will be very expensive at early because it's very expensive for us to make one or two. It's not expensive to make million. It's expensive to make one or two, right? So yes, short-term, it will be A, expensive, B, with a limited usage. Again, you drive through the city, you take off outside the city and you fly to your house, but we're making specifically a commute vehicle. This vehicle is not for entertainment. It's not for traveling, I don't know, LA to San Francisco. This is specifically from your house to work, from your work to the house. There are other use cases, but this is a specific. Now, if you're talking about future and the long term, so A, this car should be cheaper than Toyota Corolla and Ford Focus. The reason for it, when you get to their numbers, when you get to the optimized manufacturing, but the reason for it is because it's simpler. It's simpler. The amount of labor and the amount of materials going into it is actually less. So it should be affordable. We're never intended to make something only for rich people, but early adopters have that advantage, right?
A lot of vehicles calling themselves flying cars to you don't actually seem like flying cars, right? They're kind of like rebranded helicopters, maybe. I mean, have we lost sight of what the flying car actually should be? Or how do you characterize what you're making and how it's different from some of the many other models that are being developed right now?
Yes, you're 100% right. We're completely lost sight of what flying car is. So if you ask somebody like 10 years ago, what is a flying car? If you close your eyes and you think about it, you will see probably Back to the Future, Blade Runner, Fifth Element, right? All of them look the same. All of them function the same. And we knew what a flying car. Flying car looks and functions as a regular car and has a vertical takeoff. There have never been anything in history which successfully looked like a car, drove like a car, fit in a garage, like everything, just being a regular car and vertically take off. Ever. Never in history. So this is what makes a difference.
Fascinating stuff, no doubt. Jim, thank you for being here on Politico Tech.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you so much.
So that's our two-episode arc on the flying car, which, as we've learned, are now closer to being fact than fiction. But if regulation is the big hurdle, it's a safe bet the gears in Washington will grind slowly. So what do I think? Am I going to rush out to put a deposit on a Aleph Model A? Honestly, let me know when we get to teleportation. And that's our show. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in our episodes comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. If you like Politico Tech, suggest it to a friend or colleague, and make sure you subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast player. I'm Stephen Overly. See you back here on Monday.